dust hovering. She could have reached out and caught them on her fingertips, but she didn't. Instead, she allowed her gaze to follow the beam, turning her head towards the spot at which it pointed. The spot high up on the wardrobe, where the doors had come apart in the night, to reveal on the top shelf, beneath a clump of plastic bags full of clothes for St. Vinny's, an old white suitcase. Chapter 11. The Indian Ocean, 900 miles beyond the Cape of Good Hope, 1913. It took a long time to get to America. In the tales Papa had told her, he'd said it was further than Arabia, and the little girl knew it took 100 days and nights to get there. The little girl had lost count of the days, but it had been quite some time since she'd boarded the boat. So long, in fact, that she'd grown used to the sensation of never ceasing to move. Getting sea legs, it was called. She had learned all about it in tales of Moby Dick. Thinking of Moby Dick made the little girl very sad. It reminded her of Papa, the stories he read to her of the great whale, the pictures he let her look at in his studio, pictures he'd drawn of dark oceans and great ships. They were called illustrations, the little girl knew, enjoying the length of the word as she said it in her mind. And one day they might be put in a book, a real book that other children would read. For that's what her papa did. He put pictures into storybooks. Or he had on one occasion. He drew paintings of people too, but the little girl didn't like those, the eyes that followed a person across the room. The little girl's bottom lip began to tremble the way it sometimes did when she thought of Papa and Mama, and she bit down on it. In the beginning she had cried a lot. She hadn't been able to help it. She'd missed her parents. But she didn't cry much any more, and never in front of the other children. They might think she was too little to play with them, and then where would she be? Besides, Mama and Papa would be with her soon. They would be waiting for her, she knew, when the boat arrived in America. Would the authoress be there too? The little girl frowned. In all the time it had taken to find her sea legs, the authoress had not returned. This puzzled the little girl, for the authoress had given many stern instructions as to how they were to stay together always, avoid separation no matter what. Perhaps she was hiding. Perhaps it was all part of the game. The little girl wasn't sure. She was just thankful that she'd met Will and Sally on the deck that first morning. Otherwise, she wasn't sure she'd have known where to sleep, how to get food. Will and Sally and their brothers and sisters, they had so many the little girl had a hard time keeping count, knew all about finding food. They'd shown her all kinds of places on the boat where an extra serving of salt beef might be found. She didn't much like the taste, but the little boy only laughed and said it might not be what she was used to, but it did for a dog's life. They were kind to her for the most part. The only time they became cross was when she refused to tell them her name. But the little girl knew how to play games, how to follow the rules, and the authoress had told her that was the most important rule of all. Will's family had a set of bunks down on the lower decks, with lots of other men, women, and children, more people than the little girl had ever seen gathered together in one place. They had a mother travelling with them too, though they called her Ma. She wasn't at all like the little girl's own mother. She didn't have Mama's pretty face and lovely dark hair set up on the top of her head by Poppy each morning. Ma was more like the women the little girl had sometimes seen when the carriage passed through the village, with tattered skirts and boots that needed mending, and lined hands like the pair of old gloves Davies wore in the garden. When Will had first taken the little girl downstairs, Ma had been sitting on the bottom bunk, nursing one baby, while another lay crying beside her. "Who's this, then?" she'd said. She won't say her name. Says she's waiting for someone, that she's meant to be hiding.
Hiding, eh?
The woman beckoned the little girl closer.
What you hiding from then, child?
But the little girl wouldn't say, just shook her head.
Where are her folks?
I don't think she's got none, said Will. Not so as I can figure. She was hiding when I found her.
That right, child? You alone?
The little girl considered this question and decided it was better to agree than to speak of the authoress. She nodded.
Well, well then, little thing like you, all alone on the seas.
Ma shook her head and jostled the crying baby.
That's your case. Bring it here, then, and let Ma take a little look-see.
The little girl watched as Ma unhooked the latches and lifted the top, pushed aside the book of fairy tales and the second new dress to reveal the envelope below. Ma slid her finger beneath the seal and opened it, plucked a small pile of paper from within. Will's eyes widened.
Banknotes?
He glanced towards the little girl.
What shall we do with her, Ma? Tell the porter?
Ma stuffed the banknotes back inside the envelope, folded it into thirds, and tucked it down the front of her dress.
Not much point telling anyone on board, she said finally. Not that I can see. She'll stay with us till we get to the other side of the world. Then we'll find out who's waiting for her. See how they'd like to thank us for our troubles.
She'd smiled then, and dark spaces had appeared between her teeth. The little girl didn't have much to do with Ma, and for that she was glad. Ma was kept busy with the babies, one of whom seemed always to be attached to her front. They were suckling, or so Will said, though the little girl had never heard of such a thing. Not in people, anyway. She'd seen the baby animals suckling on the estate farms. Those babies were like a pair of little piglets, doing little else but squealing and drinking and fattening. And while the babies kept their ma busy, the others looked out for themselves. They were used to it, Will told her, for they had to do so at home. They came from a place called Bolton, and when there were no babies to tend, their mother worked in a cotton factory all the day long. That's why she coughed so much. The little girl understood. Her mother was also unwell, though she didn't cough the way Ma did. In the evenings, there was a spot where the little girl and the others would sit, listening to the music coming from above and the sound of feet sliding across shiny floors. That's what they were doing now, sitting in a darkened nook, listening. In the beginning, the little girl had wanted to go and see, but the other children had only laughed and said the upper decks weren't for the likes of them. That this space at the bottom of the crew ladder was as close as they were likely to get to the toff's deck. The little girl had been silent. She'd never come across rules like those before. At home, with one exception, she was allowed to go where she pleased. The only place she was forbidden was the maze that led to the authoress's cottage. But this wasn't the same, and she'd found it difficult to understand what the boy meant. The likes of them? Children? Perhaps the upper deck was a place where children were not allowed. Not that she wanted to go up there tonight. She felt tired, had felt that way for days. The sort of weariness that made her legs seem as heavy as forest logs and doubled the height of the stairs. She was dizzy, too, and her breath was hot when it passed her lips.
"Come on," said Will, tiring of the music. "Let's go look for land."
A scramble, and they were all on their feet. The little girl pulled herself up and tried to catch her balance. Will and Sally and the others were talking, laughing, their voices swirling around her. She tried to make sense of what they were saying, felt her legs shivering, her ears ringing. Will's face was suddenly close to hers, his voice loud.
"What's the matter? Are you all right?"
She opened her mouth to answer, and as she did so, her knees buckled and she began to fall. The last thing she saw before her head hit the wooden step was the bright full moon, shimmering in the sky above. The little girl opened her eyes. A man was standing above her, serious-looking, with bumpy cheeks and grey eyes. His expression remained unchanged as he moved closer and plucked a small flat paddle from his shirt pocket.
"Open?"
Before she knew what was happening, the paddle was on her tongue and he was inspecting her mouth.
"Yes," he said. "Fine."
He withdrew the paddle and straightened his waistcoat.
"Breathe."
She did so, and he nodded.
"She's fine," he said again.
He signalled to a younger man with straw-coloured hair who the little girl recognised from when she'd woken earlier.
"There's a live one here. For God's sake, get her out of the sick bay before that changes." "But, sir," said the other man, puffing, "this is the one what hit her head when she fainted. Surely she should rest a bit."
"We don't have sufficient beds for resting. She can rest when she's back in her cabin."
"I'm not sure where she belongs."
The doctor rolled his eyes.
"Then ask her, man."
The straw-haired fellow lowered his voice.
"Sir, she's the one I was telling you about. Seems to have lost her memory. Must have happened when she fell."
The doctor peered down at the little girl.
"What's your name?"
The little girl thought about this. She heard his words, understood what he was asking of her, but found she couldn't answer.
"Well?" said the man.
The little girl shook her head.
"I don't know."
The doctor sighed, exasperated.
"I don't have the time or the bed space for this. Her fever's gone. By the smell of her, she's from Steerage."
"Aye, sir."
"Well, there must be someone there who'll claim her."
"Aye, sir, there's a lad outside, the one what brought her in the other day. Come to check on her just this minute. A brother, I should say."
The doctor peered around the door to look down at the boy.
"Where are the parents?"
"The lad says his father's in Australia, sir."
"And the mother?"
The other man cleared his throat, leaned closer to the doctor.
"Giving the fishers a feed somewhere near the Cape of Good Hope, most likely, sir. Lost her leaving port 3 days ago."
"Fever?"
"Aye."
The doctor furrowed his brow and sighed shortly.
"Well, bring him in then."
A young boy, skinny as a sapling, eyes as black as coal, was hoisted before him.
"This girl belongs to you?" said the doctor.
"Yes, sir,"
said the boy.
"That is, she..."
"Enough. I don't need life stories. Her fever's gone and the bump on her head's healed. She's not saying much at this point, but no doubt she'll pipe up soon enough. It's most likely attention-seeking, knowing what happened to your mother. That's how it is sometimes, especially with children."
"But, sir..."
"That's enough. Take her away."
He turned to the crewman.
"Give the bed to someone else."
The little girl was sitting by the rails, watching the water. White-tipped peaks of blue, rippling beneath the wind's touch. The way was choppier than usual, and she surrendered her body to the rolling motion. She felt odd, not ill exactly, just strange, as if a fine white mist had filled her head and settled, refusing to drift away. It had been that way since she'd woken up in the sick bay, since the strange man had looked her over and sent her off with the boy. He'd taken her downstairs to a dark place full of bunks and mattresses, and more people than she'd ever seen before.
"Here,"
a voice at her shoulder. It was the boy.
"Don't forget your case, then."
"My case?" The little girl glanced at the proffered piece of white leather luggage.
"Core,"
said the boy, looking at her strangely. "You really have gone bonkers.
I thought you was just pretending for that doctor fellow's sake. Don't tell me you don't even remember your own case. You've been guarding it with your life the whole trip. Just about tore us apart, if any of us so much as looked at it. Didn't want to upset your precious authoress."
The strange word rustled between them, and the little girl felt an odd prickling beneath her skin.
"Authoress?" she said. But the boy didn't answer. "Land!" he called out, running to lean against the rails that ran around the deck. "There's land! Can you see it?"
The little girl came to stand by him, still clutching the handle of the small white suitcase. She glanced warily at his freckled nose, then turned to look in the direction of his pointed finger. Far in the distance, she saw a strip of land, trees of palest green all the way along it.
"That's Australia," said the boy, eyes trained on the distant shore. "My pa's there waiting for us."
Australia, the little girl thought. Another word she didn't recognize.
"We're going to have a new life there, with our own house and everything, even a bit of land. That's what my pa says in his letters. He says we're going to work the land, build a new life for ourselves.
And we will, too, even if Ma ain't with us no more," the last he said in a quieter voice.
He fell silent for a moment before turning to the little girl and cocking his head towards the shore.
"Is that where your pa is?"
The little girl thought about this.
"My pa?"
The boy rolled his eyes.
"Your dad," he said. "Fellow what belongs with your ma. You know, your pa."
"My pa," the little girl echoed, but the boy was no longer listening. He'd caught sight of one of his sisters and was running off shouting about land being sighted. The little girl nodded as he left, though she still wasn't sure what he meant.
"My pa," she said uncertainly. "That's where my pa is."
The cry of land went around the deck, and as people became busy around her, the little girl took the white suitcase to a spot by a pile of barrels, a nook to which she was unaccountably drawn. She sat down and opened the case, hoping to find some food. There was none, so she settled instead for the book of fairy tales lying on top of the other contents. As the boat drew nearer to shore, and tiny dots in the distance became seagulls, she opened the book across her lap and gazed at the beautiful black and white sketch of a woman and a deer, side by side in the clearing of a thorny forest. And somehow, though she could not read the words, the little girl realized that she knew this picture's tale, of a young princess who traveled a great distance across the sea to find a precious, hidden item belonging to someone she dearly loved.
Chapter 12. Over the Indian Ocean, 2005. Cassandra leaned against the cold, rough plastic of the cabin and looked through the window, down to the vast blue ocean that covered the globe for as far as the eye could see. The very same ocean Little Nell had traversed all those years before. It was the first time Cassandra had been overseas. That is, she'd been to New Zealand once, and had visited Nick's family in Tasmania before they were married, but never further afield. She and Nick had talked about taking off to the UK for a few years. Nick would write music for British TV, and there had to be plenty of work for art historians in Europe. But they hadn't made it, and she'd buried the dream long ago beneath the pile of others. And now here she was, aboard a plane, by herself, flying to Europe. After she'd spoken with Ben at the antique centre, after he'd given her the picture of the house, after she'd found the suitcase, it turned out there was room for little else in her mind. The mystery seemed to attach itself to her, and she couldn't shake it off, even if she tried. Truth be told, she didn't want to. She liked the constancy of preoccupation. She enjoyed wondering about Nell, this other Nell, the little girl whom she hadn't known. It was true that even after she'd found the suitcase, she hadn't intended to travel directly to the UK. It had seemed far more sensible to wait, to see how she felt in a month's time, maybe plan a trip for later. She couldn't just be jetting off to Cornwall on a whim. But then she'd had the dream, same as she'd been having on and off for a decade. She was standing in the middle of a field with nothing on the horizon in any direction. The dream had no sense of malevolence, just unendingness. Ordinary vegetation, nothing that excited the imagination. Pale, reedy grass, long enough to brush the ends of her fingers, and a light and constant breeze that kept it rustling. In the beginning, years ago when the dream was new, she'd known she was looking for someone, that if she were only to walk in the right direction, she would find them. But no matter how many times she'd dreamed the scene, she'd never seemed to manage it. One undulating hill would be replaced by another. She'd look away at the wrong moment. She'd suddenly wake up. Gradually, over time, the dream had changed. So subtly, so slowly, she didn't notice it happening. It wasn't that the setting changed. Physically, all remained as ever. It was the feeling of the dream. The certainty that she would find what it was she sought just slipped away. Until one night she knew there was nothing, no one waiting for her. That no matter how far she walked, how carefully she searched, how much she wanted to find the person she was looking for, she was alone. Next morning, the desolation had lingered, but Cassandra was used to its dull hangover and went about her life as usual. There was no sign that the day was to be anything other than ordinary until she went to the nearby shopping center to buy bread for lunch and wound up paused by the travel agency. Funny, she'd never really noticed it was there. Without quite knowing how or why, she found herself pushing open the door, standing on the seagrass matting, a wall of consultants waiting for her to speak. Cassandra remembered later feeling dull surprise at that point. It seemed she was a real person after all, a solid human being, moving in and out of the orbits of others. No matter that she so often felt herself to be living half a life, to be a half-light. At home afterwards, she'd stood for a moment, replaying the morning's events, trying to isolate the instant in which her decision had been made. How she'd gone to the shops for bread and come back with an airline ticket. And then she went into Nell's room, pulled the suitcase back down from its hiding spot, and took everything from inside. The book of fairy tales, the sketch with Eliza Makepeace written on its back, the lined exercise book with Nell's handwriting scrawled across each page. She made herself a milky coffee and sat up in Nell's bed, doing her best to decipher the god-awful handwriting, transcribing it onto a clean pad of paper. Cassandra was reasonably good at unravelling handwritten notes from previous centuries. It went with the territory for a second-hand dealer. But old-fashioned writing was one thing. It had a pattern to it. Nell's hand was just messy. Purposely, perversely messy. To make matters worse, the notebook had suffered water damage at some point in its history. Pages were stuck together, wrinkled blotches were laced with mould, and to rush was to risk tearing the pages and forever obscuring the entries. It was slow going, but Cassandra didn't need to go far to realize that Nell had been trying to solve the mystery of her identity. August 1975. Today they brought me the white suitcase. As soon as I saw it, I knew what it was. I pretended casualness. Doug and Phyllis don't know the truth, and I didn't want them to see that I was shaking.
I wanted them to think only that it was an old suitcase of Dad's that he'd wanted me to have. After they'd gone, I sat looking at it for a time, willing myself to remember who I am, where I am from. It was no use, of course, and so, at length, I opened it. There was a note from Dad, an apology of sorts, and beneath it, other things. A child's dress, mine, I suppose, a silver hairbrush, and a book of fairy tales. I recognized it immediately. I turned the cover, and then I saw her, the authoress. The words came fully formed. She is the key to my past, I'm sure of it. If I find her, I will finally find myself. For that is what I intend to do. In this notebook, I will chart my progress, and by its end, I will know my name and why I lost it. Cassandra turned carefully through the moldy pages, filled with suspense. Had Nell done what she set out to do? Found out who she was? Is that why she'd bought the house? The final entry was dated November 1975, and Nell had just arrived home to Brisbane. I'm going back as soon as I've tied things up here. I'll be sorry to leave my house in Brisbane and my shop, but what does it compare with finally finding my truth? And I'm so close. I know it. Now that the cottage is mine, I know the final answers will follow. It is my past, myself, and I have nearly found it. Nell had been planning to leave Australia for good. Why hadn't she? What had happened? Why hadn't she written another entry? Another look at the date, November 1975, and Cassandra's skin prickled. It was 2 months before she, Cassandra, had been deposited at Nell's place. Leslie's promised week or two had stretched on indefinitely until it turned into forever. Cassandra set the notebook aside as realization hardened. Nell had taken up the parental reins without skipping a beat, had stepped in and given Cassandra a home and a family, a mother, and never for an instant had she let Cassandra know of the plans her arrival had interrupted. Cassandra turned from the aircraft window and pulled the book of fairy tales from her carry-on, laid it across her lap. She didn't know what had made her so certain that she wanted to bring the book on board with her. It was the bond with Nell, she supposed, for this was the book from the suitcase, the link with Nell's past, one of the few possessions that had accompanied the little girl across the seas to Australia. And it was something about the book itself. It exercised the same compulsion over Cassandra that it had when she was 10 years old and had first discovered it downstairs in Nell's flat. The title, the illustrations, even the author's name, Eliza Makepeace. Whispering it now, Cassandra felt the strangest shiver tiptoe along her spine. As the ocean continued to stretch below, Cassandra turned to the first story and began to read. A story called The Crone's Eyes, which she recognized from the hot summer's day long ago. The Crone's Eyes by Eliza Makepeace. Once in a land that lay far across the shining sea, there lived a princess who didn't know she was a princess, for when she was but a small child, her kingdom had been ransacked and her royal family slain. It so happened that the young princess had been playing that day outside the castle walls and knew nothing of the attack until night began its fall towards earth. And she set aside her game to find her home in ruins. The little princess wandered alone for a time until finally she came to a cottage on the edge of a dark wood. As she knocked upon the door, the sky, angered by the destruction it had witnessed, broke apart in rage and spat fierce rain across the land.
Inside the cottage, there lived a blind crone who took pity on the girl and determined to give her shelter and raise her as her own. There was much work to be done in the crone's cottage, but the princess was never heard to complain, for she was a true princess with a pure heart. The happiest folk are those that are busy, for their minds are starved of time to seek out woe. Thus did the princess grow up contented. She came to love the changing seasons and learned the satisfaction of sowing seeds and tending crops. And although she was becoming beautiful, the princess did not know it, for the crone had neither looking-glass nor vanity, and thus the princess had not learned the ways of either. One night, in the princess's 16th year, she and the crone sat in the kitchen eating their supper. "What happened to your eyes, dear crone?" asked the princess, who had wondered for a long time. The crone turned towards the princess, skin wrinkled where her eyes should be.
"My sight was taken from me."
"By whom?"
"When I was but a maiden, my father loved me so much that he removed my eyes, so I need never witness death and destruction in the world."
"But, dearest crone, you can no longer witness beauty either," said the princess, thinking of the pleasure she gained from watching her garden blossom.
"No," said the crone, "and I would very much like to see you, my beauty, grow. Could we not seek your eyes somewhere?"
The crone smiled sadly.
"My eyes were to be returned by messenger when I attained my 60th year. But on the night ordained, my beauty arrived with a great lashing storm on her heels, and I was unable to meet him."
"Might we find him now?"
The crone shook her head. "The messenger could not wait, and my eyes were taken instead to the deep well in the land of lost things."
"Could we not journey there?"
"Alas," said the crone, "the way is far, and the road paved with danger and deprivation."
By and by, the seasons changed, and the crone became weaker and paler. One day, when the princess was on her way to pick apples for the winter store, she came upon the crone, sitting in the fork of the apple tree, lamenting. The princess stopped, startled, for she had never seen the crone upset. As she listened, she realized that the crone was speaking to a solemn gray and white bird with a striped tail.
"My eyes, my eyes," she said. "My end approaches, and my sight will never be restored. Tell me, wise bird, how will I know my way in the next world, if I cannot see myself?"
Quickly and quietly, the princess returned to the cottage, for she knew what she must do. The crone had sacrificed her eyes to provide the princess shelter, and now must this kindness be repaid. Although she had never travelled beyond the forest rim, the princess did not hesitate. Her love for the crone was so fathomless that if all the grains of sand in the ocean should be stacked up end to end, they would not run so deep. The princess woke with the first dawn of morning and wandered forth into the forest, stopping not until she reached the shore. There she set sail, crossing the vast sea to the land of lost things. The way was long and hard, and the princess was bewildered, for the forest in the land of lost things looked vastly different from that to which she was accustomed. The trees were cruel and jagged, the beasts ghastly. Even the birds' songs made the princess tremble. The more frightened she became, the faster she ran, until finally she stopped, her heart thundering in her chest. The princess was lost and knew not where to turn. She was about to despair when the solemn grey and white bird appeared before her.
"I am sent by the crone," said the bird, "to lead you safely to the well of lost things
where you will find your fate."
The princess was much relieved and set off after the bird, her stomach grumbling, for she had been unable to find food in this strange land. By and by she came upon an old woman sitting on a fallen log.
"How fare you, beauty?" said the old woman.
"I am so hungry," said the princess, "yet I know not where to seek food."
The old woman pointed to the forest, and suddenly the princess saw that there were berries hanging from the trees, and nuts growing in clusters on the ends of branches.
"Oh, thank you, kind woman," said the princess.
"I did nothing," said the old woman, "except to open your eyes and show you what you knew was there."
The princess continued after the bird, more satisfied now. But as they went, the weather began to change, and the wind grew cold. By and by, the princess came upon a second old woman sitting on a tree stump.
"How fare you, beauty?"
"I am so cold, yet I know not where to seek warm clothes."
The old woman pointed to the forest, and suddenly the princess saw brambles of wild roses with the softest, most delicate petals. She coated herself with them, and was much warmer.
"Oh, thank you, kind woman," said the princess.
"I did nothing," said the old woman, "except to open your eyes and show you what you knew was there."
The princess continued after the grey and white bird, more satisfied now, and warmer than before, but her feet began to ache, for she had walked so far. By and by the princess came upon a third old woman sitting on a tree stump.
"How fare you, beauty?"
"I am so tired, yet I know not where to seek carriage."
The old woman pointed to the forest, and suddenly, in a clearing, the princess saw a shiny brown fawn with a gold ring around his neck. The fawn blinked at the princess, a dark, thoughtful eye, and the princess, who was kind of heart, held out her hand. The fawn came to her and bowed his head so she might ride upon his back.
"Oh, thank you, kind woman," said the princess.
"I did nothing," said the woman, "except to open your eyes and show you what you knew was there."
The princess and the fawn followed the grey and white bird further and further into the dark forest, and as days passed, the princess came to understand the fawn's soft and gentle language. As they spoke, night after night, the princess learned that the fawn was in hiding from a treacherous hunter sent to kill him by a wicked witch. So grateful was the princess for the fawn's kindness that she undertook to keep him safe from his tormentors.
Good intentions pave the way to ruin, however,
and early next morning the princess woke to find the fawn absent from his usual place by the fire. In the tree above, the grey and white bird twittered in agitation, and the princess jumped quickly to her feet, following where the bird led. As she drew deeper into the nearby brambles, she heard the fawn weeping. The princess hurried to his side and saw there an arrow in his flank.
"The witch hath found me," spoke the fawn. "As I collected nuts for our journey, she ordered her archers to shoot me. I ran as far and as fast as I could, but when I reached this spot, I could go no further."
The princess knelt by the fawn, and so great was her distress at witnessing his pain that she began to weep over his body, and the truth and light from her tears caused his wound to heal. Over the next days, the princess tended the fawn, and once his health was restored, they continued their journey to the edge of the vast woods. When they broke finally through the rim of trees, the coastline lay before them, and the glistening sea beyond.
"Not much further north," said the bird, "stands the Well of Lost Things."
Day had ended, and dusk thickened into night, but the shingles of the beach shone like pieces of silver in the moonlight, marking their way.
They walked north until finally, at the top of a craggy black rock, could be seen the Well of Lost Things. The grey and white bird bid them farewell and flew away, her duty discharged. When the princess and the fawn reached the well, the princess turned to stroke her noble companion's neck. "You cannot come with me down the well, dear fawn," she said, "for this must I do alone." And summoning up the bravery she had discovered on her journey, the princess jumped into the opening and fell towards the bottom. The princess tumbled in and out of sleep and dreams until she found herself walking in a field where the sun made the grass glimmer and the trees sing. Suddenly, as if from nowhere, a beautiful fairy appeared with long swirling hair that glistened like spun gold and a radiant smile upon her face. The princess felt instantly at peace. "You have come a long way, weary traveller," said the fairy. "I have come that I might return to a dear friend, her eyes. Have you seen the globes of which I speak, bright fairy?" Without a word, the fairy opened her hand, and in it were two eyes, the beautiful eyes of a maiden who had seen no ill in the world. "You may take them," said the fairy, "but your crone will never use them." And before the princess could ask what the fairy meant, she woke to discover she was lying by her dear fawn at the top of the well. In her hands was a small wrapped parcel, in which lay the crone's eyes. For 3 months the travellers journeyed back across the land of lost things and over the deep blue sea to arrive once more in the princess's homeland. When they drew near to the crone's cottage, on the edge of the dark, familiar wood, a huntsman stopped them and confirmed the fairy's prediction. While the princess had been travelling in the land of lost things, the crone had passed peacefully to the next world. At this news, the princess began to weep, for her long journey had been in vain. But the fawn, who was as wise as he was good, told his beauty to stop crying. "It matters not, for she did not need her eyes to tell her who she was. She knew it by your love for her." And the princess was so grateful for the fawn's kindness that she reached out and stroked his warm cheek. Just then, the fawn was changed into a handsome prince, and his golden ring became a crown, and he told the princess how a wicked witch had put a spell on him, trapping him in the body of a fawn until a fair maiden might love him enough to weep over his fate. He and the princess were betrothed and lived together happily and busily evermore in the crone's little cottage, her eyes watching over them eternally from a jar atop the fireplace. Chapter 13. London, 1975. He was a scribble of a man, frail and fine and stooped from a knot in the centre of his knobbled back. Beige slacks with grease spots clung to the marbles of his knees. Twig-like ankles rose stoically from oversized shoes, and tufts of white floss sprouted from various fertile spots on an otherwise smooth scalp. He looked like a character from a children's story. A fairy story. Nell pulled herself away from the window and studied again the address in her notebook. There it was, printed in her own unsightly hand. "Mr. Snellgrove's Antiquarian Bookshop. Number 4 Cecil Court. Off Charing Cross Road. London's foremost expert on fairy tale writers and old books in general. Might know about Eliza." The librarians at the Central Reference Library had given her his name and address the day before. They'd been unable to rummage up any information on Eliza Makepeace that Nell hadn't already found, but had told her that if there was anyone who could help her further with her search, it was Mr. Snellgrove. Not the most sociable of fellows, that much was certain, but he knew more about old books than anyone else in London. He was as old as time itself, one of the younger librarians joked, and had probably read the Book of Fairy Tales when it was hot off the press. A cool breeze brushed against her bare neck, and Nell gathered her coat tight about her shoulders. With a deep, clear breath of purpose, she pushed open the door. A brass bell tinkled in the door jamb, and the old man turned to look at her. Thick spectacle lenses caught the light, shone like two round mirrors, and impossibly large ears balanced on the sides of his head, white hair colonizing them from within. He tilted his head, and Nell's first thought was that he was bowing, some vestige of manners from an earlier time. When pale glassy eyes appeared over the rim of his glasses, she realized he was merely improving his view of her.
"Mr. Snellgrove?"
"Yes."
Tone of a tetchy headmaster.
"Yes, indeed. Well, come in, do. You're letting the wretched air through."
Nell stepped forward, aware of the door closing behind her, a little current sucking out, leaving the warm, stale air to resettle.
"Name," said the man.
"Nell. Nell Andrews." He blinked at her.
"Name," he said again, enunciating carefully, "of the book for which you are searching."
"Of course." Nell glanced again at her notebook. "Though it's not so much a case of searching for a book." Mr. Snellgrove blinked again slowly, a parody of patience. He was weary of her already, Nell realized. This caught her off guard. She was used to playing the wearied herself. Surprise brought with it a pesky stammer.
That is, she paused, trying to compose herself. "I already have the book in question."
Mr. Snellgrove sniffed sharply, and large nostrils clamped shut.
"Might I suggest, madam," he said, "that if you already have the book in question, you have little need for my humble services."
A nod.
"Good day."
And with that he shuffled away, returned his attention to the towering bookshelf by the stairs. She had been dismissed. Nell opened her mouth, closed it again, turned to leave, stopped. No. She had come a long way to unravel a mystery, her mystery, and this man was her best chance of shedding some light on Eliza Makepeace, why she might have been escorting Nell to Australia in 1913. Pulling herself to her full height, Nell crossed the floorboards to stand by Mr. Snellgrove. She cleared her throat, rather pointedly, and waited. He didn't turn his head, merely continued shelving his books.
"You are still here."
A statement. "Yes," said Nell firmly. "I have come a long way to show you something, and I don't intend to leave until I've done so."
"I fear, madam," he said through a sigh, "that you have wasted your time just as you are now wasting mine. I don't sell items on commission."
Anger prickled Nell's throat.
"And I don't wish to sell my book. I ask only that you take a look at it, so that I might gain an expert opinion."
Her cheeks were warm, an unfamiliar sensation. She was not a blusher. Mr. Snellgrove turned to appraise her, that pale, cool, weary gaze. A thread of emotion, which one she could not tell, plucked neatly at his lip. Wordlessly, and with the slightest of movements, he indicated a little office behind his shop counter. Nell hurried through the doorway. His agreement was the sort of tiny kindness that had a habit of poking holes in one's resolve. A tear of relief threatened to break through her defences, and she dug inside her bag, hoping to find an old tissue so she might stop the traitor in its tracks. What on earth was happening to her? She wasn't an emotional person. She knew how to keep control. At least she always had. Until recently. Until Doug had delivered that suitcase and she'd found the storybook inside. The picture as its frontispiece. Started remembering things and people, like the authoress. Fragments of her past, glimpsed through tiny holes in the fabric of her memory. Mr. Snellgrove closed the glass door behind him and shuffled across a Persian carpet, dulled by its coat of long-settled dust. He navigated his way between motley mounds of books that were arranged, maze-like, on the floor, then dropped into the leather chair on the far side of the desk, fumbled a cigarette from a battered packet, and lit it. "Well," the word floated out on a stream of smoke, "come on, then. Let me cast my gaze across this book of yours." Nell had wrapped the book in a tea towel when she left Brisbane. A sensible idea. The book was old and precious. It needed protection. Yet here, in the dim light of Mr. Snellgrove's trove, the domesticity implied by its shroud embarrassed her. She untied the string and slipped off the red and white checked cloth, restrained herself from pushing it deep within her bag. Then she handed the book across the table into Mr. Snellgrove's waiting fingers. Silence descended, punctured only by the ticking of a concealed clock. Nell waited anxiously while he turned the pages, one by one. Still, he said nothing. Perhaps he required further explanation. "What I was hoping..."
"Silence!"
A pale hand was lifted. The cigarette wedged between two fingers threatened to relinquish its ash tip. Nell's words stuck in her throat. He was, without doubt, the rudest man she had ever had the misfortune to deal with, and given the character of some of her second-hand dealing associates, that was saying something. Nonetheless, he was her best chance of finding the information she needed. She had little choice but to sit, chastised, watching and waiting, as the cigarette's white body morphed into an improbably long cylinder of ash. Finally, the ash detached itself and dropped, lightly, to the ground. Joined the other dusty corpses that had died similar silent deaths. Nell, by no means a keen housekeeper, shuddered. Mr. Snellgrove took one last hungry drag and squashed the spent cigarette filter into a heaving ashtray. After what seemed an eternity, he spoke through a cough.
"Where did you come by this?"
Was she imagining the tremor of interest in his voice? "I was given it."
"By whom?"
How to answer that one? "By the author herself, I think. I don't really remember. I was given it as a child." He was watching her keenly now. His lips tightened, trembled a little.
"I've heard of it, of course. But in all my days, I confess, I've never seen a copy."
The book lay upon the table now, and Mr. Snellgrove ran his hand lightly over its cover. He let his eyelids flutter closed and uttered a sigh of deep well-being, that of the desert walker finally delivered to water. Surprised by this shift in demeanour, Nell cleared her throat and clutched at words.
"It's rare, then?"
"Oh, yes," he said softly, opening his eyes once more.
"Yes, exceptionally rare. Only one edition, you see. And the illustrations, Nathaniel Walker. This would be one of the only books he ever did."
He opened the cover and gazed at the frontispiece.
"It's a rare specimen indeed."
"And what about the author? Do you know anything about Eliza Makepeace?" Nell caught her breath as he wrinkled his gnarled old nose. "Dared to hope. She's proved rather elusive. I've only managed to turn up the most spare of details. Mr. Snellgrove pushed himself to standing and glanced longingly at the book before turning to a wooden box on the shelf behind. Its drawers were small, and when he pulled one open, Nell saw it was filled to the brim with little rectangular cards. He riffled through, muttering to himself, until finally he withdrew one.
"Here we are, then."
His lips moved as he scanned the card, and in time the volume raised.
"Eliza Makepeace. Stories appeared in various periodicals. Only one published collection." He tapped a finger on Nell's book. "Which we have right here. Very little scholarly work on her, except... yes."
Nell sat straighter. "What is it? What have you found?"
"An article. A book that mentions your Eliza. It contains a little biography, if I remember."
He shuffled to a bookcase that ran floor to ceiling.
"Relatively recent, only 9 years old. According to my note, it should be filed somewhere..."
He ran a finger along the fourth shelf, hesitated, continued, stopped.
"Here."
He grunted as he pulled down a book and blew dust from its top. Then he turned it over and squinted at the spine.
"Fairy tales and fiction weavers of the late 19th and early 20th centuries by Dr. Roger McNabb."
He licked his finger and turned to the index, traced down the list.
"Here we are. Eliza Makepeace, page 47.
He pushed the open book across the table to Nell. Her heart was racing, pulse flecking beneath her skin. She was warm, very warm. She fumbled the pages to 47, read Eliza's name at the top. Finally, finally, she was making progress. A biography that promised to flesh out the one person to whom she knew she was somehow linked.
"Thank you," she said, the words catching in her throat. "Thank you."
Mr. Snellgrove nodded, embarrassed by her gratitude. He tilted his head in the direction of Eliza's book.
"Don't suppose you're seeking a good home for this one?"
Nell smiled slightly and shook her head. "I'm afraid I couldn't part with it. It's a family heirloom." The bell tinkled. A young man stood on the other side of the glass office door, staring uncertainly at the towers of sagging shelves. Mr. Snellgrove nodded curtly.
"Well, if you change your mind, you know where to find me."
Peering over his glasses at the new customer, he huffed shortly.
"Why do they always hold the door open?"
He began his shuffle back towards the shop.
"Fairy tales and fiction weavers is £3, he said as he passed Nell's chair. "You may sit here and avail yourself of the facilities for a brief time. Just be sure and leave the money on my counter when you leave."
Nell nodded her agreement, and as the door closed behind him, heart pounding, she began to read. A writer of the first decade of the 20th century, Eliza Makepeace is best remembered for her fairy tales, which appeared regularly in various periodicals over the years spanning 1907 to 1913. She is generally credited with having authored 35 stories. However, this listing is incomplete, and the true extent of her output may never be known. An illustrated collection of Eliza Makepeace's fairy tales was published